no one in the country of any in any space had ever imagined, and that would be where the historic white majority would no longer be the majority, and that in fact the configuration that we've known for all of American history would be changing. And that has an impact on everyone in the hierarchy, everyone in the country, everyone in society, to try to figure out how do we work toward a space in which everyone can feel seen and feel that they are recognized as citizens in this country.
Well, Isabel Wilkerson, we're going to do part two of this interview of this incredible book, Cast, The Origins of Our Discontents. Isabel Wilkerson, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and winner of the National Humanities Medal. Part two coming up at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
Portland.
That is correct. KBOO Portland. It's 8 a.m. on second Wednesday of the month. We're about to hear from Paul Roland and Jackie Keeler for Wednesday Talk Radio. So keep it locked right here on your Community Connection.
Carry it on indeed. That's what we do here on KBOO Community Radio. I am Paul Roland. Glad to be aboard. Glad to have you listening. We will be taking calls later on. I and Jackie Keeler, as you heard Sonia say, 503-231-8187. Jacqueline Keeler, my second Wednesday co-host, is a Portland-based Native American writer and activist of Diné and Yankton Dakota ancestry. She co-founded Eradicating Offensive Native American Masketry and has been fighting offensive Native American maskets for many, many years, along with many others, and they have actually achieved some remarkable successes recently. And we'll be talking about the Sturgis motorcycle rally and the reopening, proposed reopening of BIA schools, among other things. Good morning, Jackie.
Good morning. Good morning.
How are you doing this morning?
Good. Good.
So we first wanted to talk a little bit about the big news in the presidential campaign and Biden finally buckling down and choosing a running mate. Got any thoughts on Kamala Harris?
Yeah, there has been a lot of discussion about him, about her. And she has quite a history in California when she was Attorney General, pursuing cases challenging tribal reservation land and also the putting of land into trust. Not only in California, but she also tried to file amicus briefs opposing tribal lands in other states.
Interesting.
And she was rejected from that. Yeah, she has a very, I mean, I think the recent article that came out in Indians.com, which says she was not good for Indian country, is the headline. Kamala Harris back in spotlight as Democratic vice presidential pick. So she has a, it begins by saying she has a record of going against tribal interests. And she was, you know, she's been questioned about this. Actually, there's a great tweet out there by Emmy Scott on Twitter. She is a Native law student, and she actually a year ago when they had the very first Democratic presidential sort of debate in Indian country, that she did ask Kamala in person about these about this. This legacy. She opposed at least 15 land of trust applications by California's Native tribes. She fought to revoke the status of Native land placed into trust for over a decade, almost 15 years. And she was actually chided for that. And she actually claimed when she was confronted by this law student, this Native law student, that she was ordered as by the governor to do so, and this wasn't her choice. But when it was reviewed, it found that the governor didn't even know she was doing it. And so it's she definitely has perspective on Native land and Native, Native homelands, which are really counter to Native sovereignty, you know, and she has quite a record on that. And she also sought to diminish the reservation boundaries for the Colorado Indian tribe.
She's never explained anything about what might have been behind those moves?
She has been asked to. The explanation she gave, particularly for the case involving, it says here that on both occasions, so she was confronted and she tried to deflect. She blamed her stance on the land into trust applications on the California governor, arguing that she was required to take action on the behest of another state official. And then, because she was,
why would the governor have ordered?
Yeah, there was a, but according to another Native outlet, Pechanga.net, independent Native-owned outlet, they said the governor had no idea Harris was sending opposition letters on Attorney General's letterhead to the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So they claim that they had nothing to do with it, that this was her own initiative.
Right, right. I guess what I'm asking is, so she was basically able to dodge it and not even have to explain, so no one had to explain what the rationale was behind, is basically what you're saying.
She gave an explanation which, according to Native news outlets, is false. Do you know what I mean? And she never got back. She had promised to get back to that law student, but she never did.
Right. I guess what I'm asking is, so why... Presumably, the further question then be, well, why? I mean, obviously, it was false that the governor did, but why would, you know, she should have been asked, well, why did the governor order it? I mean, so I guess what I'm seeing is
the governor did not order it. That's false.
No, I understand that. I guess what I'm trying to say is, so we have no way of knowing what the actual rationale is. I'm trying to get at what might have been the rationale.
Well, if you look in, you can look into, the challenges. She states it in the actual paperwork. And she was asked by Harold Frazier of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe at the debate forum, why did your office oppose these applications? And so she just claims that she did a complete she's basically very aggressively fighting any sort of incursion into the state's authority, the state of California's authority by tribes, because once that land gets taken to trust, then it goes out of the jurisdiction of the tribe, the jurisdiction which as Attorney General she oversaw. Often when you see happening in this fight for indigenous sovereignty is that states are the biggest fighters to prevent it because it infringes on their rights.
Okay.
Right. And so
this is a pattern.
This is part of a pattern in which she partook very aggressively. And so it's California Native tribes have really been, they were the victims of genocide at a level that, you know, tribes inland were not. And because of the coastal territories they occupy there in California, and so for them getting land back is you know, I mean, here she's fighting tooth and nail over, what was it, like 11 acres, you know? I mean, we're talking about not huge parcels of land for people who have been the victims of genocide. And so, yeah, it's, but states, I often say the maxim is, you know, when states are powerful, tribes are weak. When tribes are powerful, states are weak. There's no, you know, because states only exist, if you, you know, look at the formation of territories and states according to, you know, the U.S. law, they only exist when they're able to subdue and to subdue tribes and to reduce their sovereignty, and have enough, you know, have enough white voters there to outnumber us. So the very existence of states, the political existence, is dependent on the destruction of the sovereignty of the indigenous nations whose homelands they are overseeing and occupying.
Well, you know, I spoke briefly last week about the unratified treaties of 1851 in Oregon, but of course the Oregon-California kind of twin, the sort of linked historically because they're over, you know, I think it was maybe 19 treaties with the ones you're talking about, the tribes you're talking about, you know, because of the, you know, the gold rush era, that they had massive numbers of treaties that had already been negotiated in good faith by the tribes, but then were never ratified, which is what one of the big things that helped lead to the genocide you're talking about.
Yes, in this Big Lagoon case, the 11-acre case, the top official at the time, she tried to block a small tribe from pursuing a casino on an 11-acre site that was placed in trust in 1994. Her argument struck fear across Indian country, raising concerns that anyone could go back in time and challenge the status of tribal land. The principles at stake in this case matter for scores of tribes and millions of acres in tribal land. Sam Hirsch, a top official at the Department of Justice who argued the case on behalf of the federal government, told the Los Angeles Times, "We had a responsibility to stand up for those American Indians whose interests were endangered." An en banc panel of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals rejected every argument raised by Kamala Harris in the case. The vote among the 11 judges was unanimous. So the court upheld the finding the state failed to negotiate a Class III gaming compact in good faith, as required by the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act. And so, the tribal attorney said it's a meaningful decision and the right decision. This is not even the only case. You know, we're talking many cases here. 15 cases where she opposed land in a trust in California. So, it's quite, and probably the Colorado River case, probably the Colorado River tribe, probably has to do with the claim to water that the state of California has on the Colorado River. So, you know, these are limited resources, and she certainly seemed to be opposed to Native access to resources.
Well, you know, if she was indeed acting, you know, according to her role, you know, state role, I guess one could allow her the possibility that if she was in a federal position, that she would then look at things from that perspective, perhaps.
Yeah, I would hope so. I mean, now she knows that she's being observed. I don't know. I mean, possibly she thought that California Native tribes were, that nobody would notice or raise a fuss publicly. You know, wouldn't be a national issue, you know, because people don't really even know California Native tribes still exist. But now she's got the attention of all the tribes across the United States, and they will be watching her and monitoring her very carefully on her policies and the policies of the administration, the Biden administration generally, or, you know, the potential Biden administration generally. But, Biden has made a lot of statements about support for sovereignty and stuff, and so did she at that particular the Franklin Muir debate. It does go to say, like, how much does a track record matter? I mean, actually, this sort of really aggressive attack is not that normal for attorney generals to take. It's actually, unless you're in a really Republican red state. There was also an attorney general in Washington State, Ferguson, who was incredibly aggressive towards Native claims. And so, but it's usually sort of an unusual thing for them to do, particularly because this was already determined by the federal government, by the Bureau of Indian Affairs 15 years earlier. It was particularly unusual to challenge it. And mm-hmm. to challenge, you know, a state, a tribe out of state is also unusual as well.
So I wonder, it might be helpful just to, if you don't mind, just to sort of go over, you know, give a thumbnail sketch of what does trust mean? What is the trust relationship? I think there's still some confusion about that. You know, putting land into trust, keeping land in trust, what does that mean?
So trust is at the point, so when land gets put into trust, then it becomes, we are supposed to have this trust relationship with the U.S. government. And so, you know, with the U.S. government, you know, occupying, having military domination over our homelands, you know, this is seen as a way of, you know, still recognizing Native rights to land without recognizing, without actually title, without the U.S. giving up federal title of land. And so, because there was this decision, I think I brought this up on the show before, there are the three decisions that were made back in the early 1820s, 1830s by Chief Justice John Marshall, Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And these particular ones are called the Marshall Trilogy in Indian federal law, right? And in one of them, he ruled... well, he was asked to rule over two white landowners who claimed the right to the same property. They claimed to have title to the exact same property, and so he had to decide between these two white men whose title was legitimate, right? And one of them had gotten title through the state, and one had gotten title through the tribe, right? And so we're talking, this is a brand new country with not a lot of legal precedent, you know, and so he sort of had to sort of look around different legal sources around the world, kind of scrounge around and find something that might be relevant. And he actually turned to Vatican law, a law from the Vatican that made through papal bulls issued by a couple of popes. And one was in 1492 and one was in 1551. And in those, the pope was, the two popes, they were addressing, you know, this sort of rivalry between Portugal and Spain over who could occupy what colonial territory. And so as the kind of Christian head of these, you know, different nations in the 15th and 16th centuries, they basically, the popes decided that, you know, this is why... kind of gave a longitudinal, and they just decided to kind of divide up the world for colonialism, right? This is why you know, Portugal got Brazil and all this stuff, and so anyway. But part of the decision was that this idea of discovering nations, right? That with a discovering Christian nation landed on a in a home, in a place, at a country that was occupied by people who were not Christian, right? And that no other Christian nature had discovered them, they had the right to plant their flag there. And usually they did it at the mouth of a river and claimed the whole river system, right? And then they would claim that for their country. And at that moment that they landed and made the claim, then all of the fee simple title of the land would then revert to that discovering country. And that the native people who lived there would then, who only had the title that animals possessed of occupation and use, right? And so this was what he referenced in this. So that, you know, the white man who had the title to the tribe, you know, his title was not valid, but the white man who had the title through the state, his title was valid. So you see the way in which even back then you're playing against the state's authority and the tribe's authority, right? And at that moment that they then said that we weren't human enough to have title to the land, right? And this is still the basis of basically real estate law in the U.S. The U.S. considers itself an inheritor of that status of being a Christian discovering country and under papal law. And so they, because of course the United States did not exist in 1492 and 1551. So what Marshall says is that they inherited that status, right, as a colonial government. And so so this is why the U.S. has superior title to land to Native nations. And so this is where the trust relationship grows out of. A trust, I say that in quotation marks, of course. And so it's just, so this is like the basis of all this is incredibly racist and you know, based in religious beliefs, right? And so it's, yeah, it's still been, it's still the active law of the land of the United States and some other discovering countries as well, like Canada and Australia, and so discovering colonial nations. And then and it was cited as recently as 2005 by Justice Ginsburg when in the case of the city of Sherrill, New York versus the Oneida Nation, where the city of Sherrill, I've brought this case before as well, had made a deal with the Oneida Nation to pay them $1 a year for like 99 years back in the late 19th century to have title to the land that the city was on, right? So they would ceremoniously present the Oneida people with this $1 and, you know, some other things. And then, and it was a sort of fun thing. And then when the 99 years were up, they realized the Oneida Nation was still around as a political entity. And then they became very nervous because then the Oneida Nation of New York started demanding actual, like, value, the present-day value for the land, for rent. And so this threw everyone's title, clouded their title and all this stuff. So they took it to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court cited this doctrine of discovery. And so so then denying the Oneida Nation's title to the land. And so... Yeah, so this whole thing of what then Attorney General, now Senator Kamala Harris, what she was doing was really in the tradition of this, of challenging Native title, of trying to prevent it, and once it gets into trust, then you know, of course the goes out of the jurisdiction of state, which means that they can't tax and stuff like that.
But the language of the trust relationship, I just want to add a couple things. So basically indigenous peoples of what's now the United States were basically under the War Department, and that got kind of transferred to the Interior Department as the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So explain the language of trust. Do you know how that developed? Because basically, the trust means that it's land that's like, it's almost like the native people are like children or wards of the state, right? In essence, that the land is sort of held to them until they, you know, until you all become adults or something like that. And so that's the trust.
That is the language that is used, and I think that is helpful to know. But I think that it's also helpful to understand that this is the basis of U.S. claims to our land, and that it's something that people can challenge in constructive ways by demanding that they stop citing the doctrine of discovery. I think that is, obviously the U.S. has very derogatory ideas about Native people, the U.S. government, and certainly I want to emphasize that for people to understand that. But I think, you know, I think the best focus is actually on how do we, you know, actual constructive ways to stop it. And mm-hmm. So I think that challenging the doctrine of discovery is really crucial, and creating a different relationship and recognizing the title of Native people inherently, not because it's held in trust in as you know, to a sort of patronizing way, paternal way, by the U.S. government. And so, I mean, this is why if you get someone in office who you don't know where they stand on this issue and it's not clear, then it becomes an existential crisis for Native people, where another sort of termination, genocidal era becomes a political possibility. And so that's why it's very important for Native nations to get Kamala Harris to really make sure that she has changed and that she's not going to backslide into that kind of behavior again, which for some reason was very, very natural for her to do. You know, it was very, very, you know, she was doing it a lot, you know, and we're not talking about one case here, you know. And so it's, you know, what is,
of course,
her, if, you know. So, I mean, if you, about where her rationale comes from, and probably reviewing all the filings she did might reveal something, or a former staffer of hers explaining it. A lot of lawyers don't take Indian federal law in school. It's not required.
Well, that's what I was going to say. If you haven't been exposed to it, and you go to law school and everything you read, if you don't take a course like that or have a professor or do your own independent reading or, you know, have Native activist friends or whatever, you're just going to go along with the dominant paradigm, I imagine. Well, that's something to, I'm glad you, that's really helpful. Something to follow. I wanted to maybe just sort of lead into, I think it relates directly, lead into this decision by the Bureau of Indian Affairs to open tribal schools, because that is another area that those tribal schools are on, you know, reservation land, so-called trust land, and the BIA has traditionally a paternalistic attitude, especially or worse under Trump. But so talk about that decision, and is that basically a unilateral decision, and can they make such a decision unilaterally?
Yeah, so a number of the schools the Bureau of Indian Affairs runs directly on tribal land, and so the Bureau of Indian Affairs is, of course, part of the Department of the Interior, and yes, we are put in there with animals and land and stuff like that, and then they run 53 schools, Bureau of Indian Education schools that are run by the federal government across 10 states. And they announced last week that they were going to reopen the brick and mortar schools under its jurisdiction to the maximum extent possible on September 16th. And so this is while a number of reservations are under some of the strictest lockdowns. The Navajo Nation has been going on 57-hour lockdowns over weekends for months now, Janine, and tribes are preventing. In South Dakota, we did pollination. We're the editor in chief. We did a number of shows about the particularly about the COVID checkpoints in South Dakota, with actual Chairman Harold Frazier, and these Lakota reservations, including my father's reservation, the Yankton Sioux Reservation in South Dakota, have also been preventing Sturgis riders from coming through the reservation, who are going to the Sturgis rally in the Black Hills in South Dakota, and so they turned them away from being able to drive through. So the tribes are taking the pandemic very seriously, but of course the federal government and then particularly the state Republican leaders. Governor Noem in South Dakota was incredibly aggressive, trying to stop the tribes from doing these COVID checkpoints. Right? They basically were not allowing unnecessary traffic through their reservation, and so it does seem like they want to open. I mean, these are vectors to contagion, and they seem to, for the Navajo Nation, all these different tribes, the levels of infection and death are really taken quite seriously, and early on the Navajo Nation was constantly ranked up there with some of the highest states and cities in the country, and although they have been able to flatten the curve through very strict lockdown measures, and so they have a curfew. If you actually disobey the curfew, you can get a $1,000 fine on the reservation. Or time in jail, and that's been controversial, but it's also been because it's sort of, I don't know, Navajo people are kind of, do we really want to be charging people $1,000? But they have managed to flatten the curve and to really reduce their but of course the state of Arizona has been increasing its rates through lack of measures, and of course it's with the Sturgis rally, there's a fear there's going to be a rate rise in South Dakota as well, in the neighboring states, They're constantly fighting the Republicans around them to try to protect their communities. So this is just seen as another attempt to sort of open up the tribal communities to disease and to infection. So President of the Union that represents the Bureau of Indian Education employees, Sue Parton, said, "I am concerned about the infection, the spread of the virus to our staffing, to the teachers, to the employees." And she says that I look at it from the aspect of being a Native American community member myself, and I worry about the spread throughout our Native community, and I don't want to see that happen, and I just don't think there has been enough scientific evidence to show that it's safe for staff and students to go back to school as normal. And of course, a lot of Native reservations, of course, do not have a lot of infrastructure, and there are going to be challenges to doing remote schooling because of the lack of cellular and Wi-Fi service. The tribes have been working to utilize the COVID dollars they finally got. They got them months after the rest of the nation did, and so they are trying, and they have to use them by the end of the year. Trump put that deadline on there, and so they can't pursue larger projects, but they have to try to immediately try to increase Wi-Fi service for students, all that kind of thing. So it's there's a lot of things that they're trying to deal with, and this is just another thing that was thrown into it all. There has been calls for Tara Sweeney to step down. She is the she's the head of the Bureau of Indian Affairs under Trump, and she's taken stances that many feel are pro-termination of other tribes. She herself is Alaska Native, but a lot of the National Congress of American Indians has already called for her to step down, her resignation, and this later decision by her to open the schools is sort of very It's just another way in which she's out of step with the rest of the Native community.
So would you say that I guess it's kind of speculation, but the obvious explanation to me, common sense, seems to be that, Trump pushing so hard for schools reopening, this is the one area of schools that the federal government has direct control over. So it seems like that would be the obvious explanation.
Yeah, although I don't think that most of his voter base cares much about tribes, what happens to them or not, and so I don't.
Well,
think
it's just an exertion of power, basically.
Oh yeah, definitely, and it's one that is maybe they would enjoy watching tribes be exposed to the virus. It's just par for the course, I should say, and so.
So you mentioned Sturgis. Oh, let me first say that it's 8:30 in the morning. We're halfway through this hour-long live morning talk show, Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm the regular weekly host, Paul Rowland, and my second Wednesday co-host is Jacqueline Keeler. We're both on the phone due to the COVID virus, and the number to call in to get your comment or question in is 503-231-8187. Yeah, so Sturgis, what can you say about Sturgis? I mean, first of all, people should know that is where the sacred Bear Butte is, and there's been ongoing conflict. I was reading an old article where some historic bar burned down a few years ago, and they wanted to rebuild it, like right at the base of Bear Butte. And there's been ongoing conflict over Bear Butte and the town for ever since it got established. And so this massive motorcycle ride that can sometimes draw up to 500,000 people, you can imagine it. I guess they said, I haven't seen any actual estimates, but they estimated somewhat lower, maybe 250,000 this year. Still a heck of a lot of people. And you did mention already that the tribes are blocking at the checkpoints bikers from going through accessing it through the reservations. What do you want to say about Sturgis?
Yeah, that is interesting. We were looking at doing a show about it.
I just want to say, by show you mean your Pollen Nation magazine podcast, which I neglected to mention at the outset. That's a Pollen Nation, Pollen Nation magazine on Facebook, or pollennationmagazine.com or .org?
I think it's .com, yeah.
Okay, pollennationmagazine.com or on Facebook. Go ahead.
Yeah, so we, we were contacted by Native women who were organizing a missing and murdered Indigenous women's ride. And they, Sturgis is also a location of trafficking, of women and girls, and they wanted to do a ride to honor MIW, missing and murdered Indigenous women, and that's forthcoming. The site, the Black Hills, is sacred to my father's people, to the Lakota and Dakota people, and other nations as well, Native nations. That's where they ride into every year. The estimates by the New York Times was about 250,000, which is, much lower than the normal number, about half the number that attended last year. And there's very little masking up going on there. And so it's quite a lot to think. We spoke about this before. With Trump, it's coming on the 4th of July, coming to the Black Hills, to Mount Rushmore. And the Black Hills, under treaty ratified by the U.S. Senate, is supposed to be part of the Great Sioux Nation. So it is land that is illegally held and occupied by the U.S. government. That's sort of what caused the war between the different Lakota nations and their allies, and the U.S. Army fighting over the Black Hills. Colonel Custer brought a mining party into the Black Hills to ascertain the gold in the Black Hills, and that gold, they took out billions of a lot of gold, and that basically was part of what helped the U.S. get back. Economically after the Civil War. So they violated the treaty by coming in and doing this mining party and search. And so this then led to a resurgence of the Indian Wars there with the Lakota Nation. And it led to Custer's defeat. So that whole area is supposed to be part, under treaty, under the Fort Laramie Treaty, is supposed to be our land. And the Mount Rushmore and the Bear Butte in particular are sacred sites. Those mountains are holy, are Wakan, right? So they actually carving the founding father, or the four presidents' faces on Mount Rushmore, is highly offensive. This is a sacred mountain, and they defaced it. And so Trump sort of made a point of coming on the 4th of July. And he actually, there was recently reported that he wants his face on added as if although they said there's no more stable rock face structure to put.
Well,
his
that's
face
fitting.
On.
That's somehow fitting, isn't it?
Yeah. In fact, it was reported by the Argus leader there in South Dakota that's the governor Noem again. She's a Republican and a Trump supporter. She says that the first time she met Trump at the White House, that was the first thing he asked her, was if he could have his face added to Mount Rushmore. And she actually thought that was hilarious, but she found out that he was serious about it.
Well, she's got a underneath her fawning, opportunist fawning and political posturing and racist behavior, there's at least a little bit of common sense there. So into this whole mix, first we had Trump going to the sacred Black Hills on the 4th of July. Now we got all these riders who are possibly, likely bringing contagion into these very, these embattled reservation areas. I say embattled because they've been trying so hard to keep the contagion out. And now, who knows what's going to happen, obviously. But anyway, so, I just wanted to add, maybe you could riff off of this, that, I was reading some sort of little portraits of people who are going there, and a number of them say things either directly or indirectly that just make it sound like basically that's their community. This is their community gathering place, which is really, in a way, kind of a sad commentary on the United States, that people have to travel so far and go to these places to find community. And I was looking back, and I remembered that there was a rainbow gathering in the Black Hills just 3 years ago, which is another place where people, I don't know, to some extent, there's a sort of desperate longing for community. I don't know. What do you think about that?
Yeah, actually, that rainbow gathering was in 2015, and I did cover it and spoke to folks about it. And yeah, that is interesting. It's and of course, we did a show recently on Pollination about the most recent rainbow gathering, which was on Nimiipuu, Nez Perce lands there in Idaho, and there was a standoff there as well. And pretty much every year when the rainbow gathering happens, and that's where they gather in the tens of thousands to megacamp on these sacred sites. And I spoke to Nimiipuu leaders who were there, and they said that there's no cleanup that really happened the way they claim it happened. When I spoke to Rainbow, they technically say they don't have leadership, which is how they're able to megacamp, because the Forest Service says that they can't stop individuals from all gathering in those numbers. And I think that's the ridiculous thing, because yet they prevent tribes from going and doing their sacred ceremonies, because tribes have leaders and they have to actually apply through official channels to utilize their own sacred sites, right? And so once again, you have basically white people enjoying white privilege and being able to manipulate the system to get what they want. And very similar.
Listen, I got to interrupt you. I should have resolved this problem, which happened, I think, last week. This one phone that I use in my upstairs here, actually, it starts to lose power. I think you're hearing some beeps. So let me just let Sonia, the engineer, know, and you know, that I'm going to actually have to hang up. And you can just continue talking about Sturgis. And I'm going to go get a different phone, which is fully charged, and I'm going to call back Sonia on the studio line, and so to make this as less awkward as possible. So please continue about about what we've been talking about, the Sturgis motorcycle rally and the rainbow gathering, et cetera. And sorry, I don't know if this is going to mess the... maybe Sonia, you could tell me, is this going to mess up? Are you going to hear the tone signal, the hang up signal, if I do that?
Well, we'll find out in a moment. I've got some music queued up to, if we need to take
actually,
a little recess.
Hear, I don't hear the beep. Let's just wait and see if that's going to happen. I just started to hear it. I got a little worried because it was awkward last time. So let's just hold off on that. Maybe the charge will hold. Anyway, sorry for the technical banter here on the air, but we'll cross that bridge when we get to it. Yeah, so the Sturgis motorcycle. Well, actually, before we go to that, I noticed that Camilo has been waiting on the line. If he's still there, let's go to hear what Camilo has to say. Are you there, Camilo?
Yes, I am. Good morning. I just wanted to respond to the Kamala Harris nomination. And I think this is going to be very bad for the progressives and in any attempt to move the party further to the left. I think this is going to institutionalize corporate Democrats, not only in this administration, but in the next administration, too. I mean, I think that, the fear of Donald Trump's reelection is so great that people are really not paying attention to the substantive issues that these two candidates are very poor on. And I noticed that there's beginning to be a little bit of discussion about this on Facebook by some of our progressive, particularly people who are supporters of Bernie. So I wish we could hear from your audience. I know there's not very much time, but I think that we've got to really dig deeply into this on KBOO in our morning talk shows, and you know, just make sure that the emphasis is not just on winning the election, but on moving the institutional Democratic Party as far to the left as we possibly can, and try not to let this become a deepening of the resistance as we've seen from the DNC for so many years.
Jacqueline, what do you have any response?
Yeah, I think that obviously the goal, I mean, right now what we have with Trump is a direct attack on Native sovereignty on many, many levels, and of course sacred lands and our communities. But what we really, of course, we do want a change. We want it to be substantively different, and for the Democratic Party to help with that process. It is very, when we look at the actual sort of track record of Kamala Harris, it is disturbing. And obviously the tribal leaders and even younger Native people have brought this up before, but it was certainly ignored in the final decision making. I should say that Congresswoman Deb Haaland of New Mexico, who is from Laguna Pueblo, and Congresswoman Cherise Davids of Kansas, they both support Kamala Harris, I understand. But I think, that makes sense to me because they are, Democrats and they want to see, change in the White House. But I do wish they, and I do hope they hold her accountable to that record and make sure that there isn't any sort of the administration that would emerge from this nomination would be one that would be completely supportive of Native rights and Native sovereignty, and if we're going to push it farther to the left, to take it beyond the trust relationship, but of course that might require congressional approval or a law, but that it become about recognizing our sovereignty in a much more complete way over our territories.
Of course, the left's relationship to Indigenous people, to Native Americans, is an interesting discussion in and of itself, and perhaps beyond the scope of this conversation. But thank you, Camilo, for bringing that up. That's probably a broader conversation, as you said, that really needs to be happened. I'll think about who I can have on as a guest in the next weeks to follow up on that. I think you're totally right. That's a critical conversation, and it's not either or. It's not defeating Trump or criticizing and holding the other candidates accountable. It can be both. So thank you for bringing that up. Do you have any final comments before we let you go? Oh, I guess Camilo's gone. 503-231-8187. We have, only about 10 minutes left. So if you want to get a comment or question, you better do it right now. So we've talked about a lot of stuff. I'll leave it up to you. You want to continue talking about what we're talking about? I had a couple other things. But, you got the mic.
Okay. So I would say that we're going to be doing a show looking at bringing on. So there are a lot of Native people who are motorcycle riders themselves, and they have formed riding clubs. And one of them is a Native women's riding club. And of course, they're going to be doing a ride to honor missing and murdered women coming up soon. And they're going to speak to that. And you know, part of that is what they brought forward to me, the writers, was this issue of pretendianism as well, which we've been covering on our show and getting a lot of feedback from. And
just want to say that's Pollination. When you say our show, people might think this show, which we have also talked about.
Yes,
but,
Yes. I am the editor-in-chief of Pollination Magazine, and we do a podcast and about issues pertinent to Indian Country. And so we our audience is very active and you know, they've been very supportive of it. And so but the issue there was that, you know, we had a white woman basically steal the idea of this MIW thing and then try to conduct it herself. And so so that's so they're gonna do their own, and so it's there's so many issues that are in this, and but I just wanted to note that that's coming up, and we'll be covering that and hearing their perspective and why they ride and how they use that to honor Native women and to be a sign, actually how they use these motorcycles to be a sign of strength, you mean, mm-hmm. for Native women. It's a really interesting interview. I talked to them extensively last few days, and it's given me insights into that. I knew.
And what day is
that
going to be?
That will be next week. So that's not going to be this week. We're going to be speaking to folks who have been impacted by pretendianism and Native folks, and how that's, you know, I mean, how that's impacted their tribes, their urban communities, their artwork, everything having to confront the sort of the fraud that goes. And of course, the fraud is only made possible through the history of genocide, and I find that particularly egregious that people would take advantage of genocide to make space for themselves as fake Indians, and then to take financially from one of the poorest communities in the country.
Well, it looks like we got another caller, might be our last one. Jeremy, go ahead. What's your comment or question? Hello, Jeremy?
Yeah, I agree with the last caller who said what a disaster I think she is as a pick. But I was wondering, I mean, she filed amicus briefs while she was Attorney General of California to, you know, disempower Native people. And is she in the pocket of some, you know, energy company or something? What's driving her antipathy to you know, those land claims?
Well, I don't know. I think I'm going to take some time and review it more carefully. I think I looked at the reporting and they didn't really get in that deep. I think to figure that out, I'm going to have to actually read the filings themselves and try to talk to someone who used to work in her office. That's probably what I will have to do. And I am very curious too. It seems sort of out of her, I don't know. I don't know why the obsession with it. Obviously, with the Big Lagoon case, there was a casino on the line. I don't know why she was, if it was opposition to the casino exactly. With the Colorado water, the tribe's case, you know, that was possibly tied to water claims on the Colorado River, which the state of California is incredibly dependent on. And so I would think that it's conflict over resources that drove that, and maybe it does seem like there may be just a notion that tribe, I don't know. The question is, does she actually think that tribe should not exist? Do you mean that tribe should not have jurisdiction? Because when it is put into trust, tribes do get jurisdiction. Not only does the state lose the right to tax or to police tribal lands, but the tribes themselves have jurisdiction, and so you're subject to tribal courts and tribal everything, and that jurisdiction is expanding with particularly under the Violence Against Women's Act, where they were given more jurisdiction to over domestic violence of non-natives on their reservations. And so it's I don't know why she's opposing this.
Maybe she just wants all the money in the hands of the federal government so she can give it to the police and
well, no, she was a state attorney general, so it was
a
California state thing.
Yeah,
I understand but you know, if they lose the ability to tax, you know, Native activities, then they'll they'll be losing money that she would like to give to the police or for capital punishment. She's just such a disaster. Anyway, thanks a lot. This has been really
interesting. Yeah, I will look into it, though, definitely.
Yeah, no, it would be really interesting. It'd be really interesting as the campaign goes on to see if, you know, if there are questions brought up. Obviously, the COVID is going to really change the whole campaign. And I guess there will be, presumably there will be debates. We don't know for sure. But obviously, it'd be interesting if some Native reporters actually get a chance to talk to her about that. It'll be interesting if Biden does get elected, how she will deal with these questions, which she'll be obviously forced to. Well, it looks like we have one last caller, real quick. Brian, go ahead with a quick comment or question.
Oh, yeah. Well, this just reminds me that what I've been saying for a while now, that once we get Biden in, hopefully that's just the beginning of the battle. And I was just wondering if you have any suggestions for, you know, it's kind of hard to think about after the election, but after the election, when the real work starts to make these happier, friendlier faces go in the direction of justice, what are some of the best organizations you think to be involved with to help that happen? It's not going to be, kind of, in a way, not as easy as fighting against Trump, who's such a ludicrous figure. I mean, this is going to be a little harder in a way, right?
Yeah, I would say, I think that there are, the Native Nations have a number of organizations that that advocate for them at the federal level, and that would include the National Congress of American Indians and also, you know, support Native journalism, because certainly we are the ones who are keeping the closest eye on these different issues and need a greater voice at that level in order to be heard. I think publications like Pollination Magazine are few and far between, and the kind of investigative reporting is really not being done consistently by other outlets. Most sources I quoted today were Native sources like Indians.com and other outlets as well.
That's Indians with a Z, Indians.com. Yeah. Maybe just to be, I've never asked you this on thing. Do you have like maybe five favorite journalists and or websites and or print publications for people to turn to get good news from Indian country?
Yeah, I mean, I like Indians.com and I like Native News by, which is managed by Levi Rickert from the Midwest, and I do get stuff from Indian Country Today, of course, a lot of great stuff. The Navajo Times, which is incredible. They have an incredible newsroom. I would totally recommend them as a source. And I think that those are the primary ones, I think. And I get a lot of sources from first-person sources, people who contact me, which we then put together in shows. Those are probably the primary ones. Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's helpful. I will try to compile that list and put that on our program page. Well, we've only got a couple minutes left. Any further thoughts to lead people towards how to think about the Indian country in these COVID and Trump and very stressful times?
Yeah, God, you know, it's just I think my book is coming out. I turned in the manuscript to my publisher on a week ago Monday, and so I'm expecting edits and galleys coming back, but we'll be
congratulations. All right.
Yeah, so that's called Standoff, and it compares the Bundy takeovers to Standing Rock, and I really are really positioning it as sort of an answer, like what happened the last 4 years, how do these two standoffs that took place in 2016 sort of epitomize the polarization of this country, the different historical interpretations, and I go into a lot of depth there. And so I would recommend checking that out when it comes out. And I'm sure Cebu will be offering opportunities to read it. it's coming out in March, and I'm really happy about it. And I hope that it will be coming out in a a new administration where we can kind of begin to sort of do some soul searching as a nation. And also, I don't know how Trump is going to take if he loses. Will he be rattling the cage to get an armed response? And in which case, my book will be even more valuable because you'll need to understand the Bundys and the sort of these militia groups. And I go into it and their history all the way back to the English Civil War in the 1600s. So it's I do some pretty deep diving. And then of course with Standing Rock, I really look at the Lakota and Dakota, history and traditions of which my grandmother's family, the Delorias, have done a lot of writing on in the past 100 years. And so I sort of compare the Bundys to the Delorias philosophically and historically. And so it's a unique take, and I hope it's very useful in trying to analyze how we got here and why it happened.
All right. Well, that's a heads up, something to look forward to as we enter into a really, really precarious time in United States history. Of course, the Native people know well about precarious times, and thankfully have lived like yourself to tell these stories. So thank you, Jacqueline Keeler. Always really, really good to hear you on the air and to engage with you. Thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, and bye-bye, everybody.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
The public sculptures, they're not necessarily part of the conversation to say we would love a $20,000 public sculpture in some of our small kind of micro centers. We would love to bring in